who shot these people, but they clearly were the cause of this 1,200 people, and going back all 75 years and more, the death of even their soldiers who are lying in their cemeteries. Basically, the Palestinian Muslims, Christians, and Jews are to be blamed squarely on the Zionists of Israel. Remove that, and there will not be this death, and it was not anti-Semitism. That's a blatant lie. It's disgusting, because it's the Muslims who took us in, and instead of showing the gratitude that's required, they are vilifying, and they've come to this point where they so dehumanized the people of Palestine that the world, at least the part of the world that is silent, is able to accept that the people of Gaza are like bugs, that they can murder them because they dehumanize them and demonize them. But we as Jews are screaming and crying. This is unacceptable. We are day and night, we walk, because on Sabbath, a lot of the demonstrations are on Sabbath. And our communities, whether it's in Palestine,
well,
whether it's
in Israel, that.
We go out in streams.
I'm going to get to that.
Because we cannot be silent
right,
on this.
Right. But before that, going back to Gaza itself, what do you think the Israelis, what's their goal here in Gaza?
Well, again, when you say the Israelis, even that, although I'm not condoning any of the Israelis or anything, but I'm sure it cannot be that the Israelis as a whole, there's many who are opposed to it, I'm sure, because it's so, to do such a thing is so ungodly. But it's the leadership who they have, and the ones who are supporting them, their goal is they want to somehow recreate the world. They obviously want to stop the opposition, which is an impossibility because you can't oppress a people. So maybe one of their plans is to totally throw them out of the land entirely, because you cannot oppress a people. An action brings a reaction. You cannot oppress human beings and expect them to thank you for it and they will be silent. So they are the personification of anti-Semitism. They're causing the death of Jews, and they cannot do what they're doing. But there are people who are buying into that. And then there's people of the other parts of Israel, maybe who are just simply, they have what we'd call fear, a panic, that they don't see themselves out of it, and so they can only think 2 inches ahead of their nose, and that means that we got to protect ourselves because we're going to be slaughtered by that skillful propaganda, PR of the Zionists, that they're so afraid of the Arabs and Muslims, the narrative of the Zionists, that they equate the Palestinians with the Nazis, which they do constantly. And we've heard this all the time.
Right.
So that's why they buy. Again, we're not condoning their thought process. But this is what it's coming from a powerful, incessant 75 years of propaganda of the Zionists. I could say, our communities, where I lived, and even in Jerusalem, the very religious communities, a lot of us are children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. My father-in-law was in Auschwitz. He passed away recently. And he would wake up with dreams, nightmares, till he passed on. My father escaped from the Nazis when they came into Hungary, and his parents were killed in Auschwitz, as the majority of my mother's family from Poland and from Hungary. So basically, we know that suffering, it's in our blood, and that fear is right on the step when somebody suffered something terribly. So they're always afraid. Yeah, even though we believe in God and we look for God's protection, but you know, when somebody comes along and says, these are our partners with the Nazis, you think twice. So the Zionists use skillfully the Holocaust as a tool to create fear amongst the Jews, and that they should be able to look for protection. Mm-hmm. And that's how they use to vilify the people of Palestine, which is unacceptable.
The people of Palestine, we've been talking about Gaza, but I also looking at the West Bank, that it's just an unbelievable amount of people who have been killed there this year, and the regime has been just unbelievable with their violence with them and destroying their homes and killing individuals. At the same time, though, in Quds itself, from your community, even though the oppression is a lot, but in your community, inside of Quds, they have been standing up. I want to talk about that a little bit.
Oh, yes.
And the oppression
yes.
that they are yeah. facing too.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, from before the creation, maybe the first famous martyr was somebody called Dr. Dahan. He was this is a picture of. This is of his funeral procession in 1924. He came from Denmark. He was non-religious. He decided to become religious. He was a friend of the king of Denmark. There's a statue of him in Denmark. The king escorted him when he decided to become religious. And he decided, what does it mean to become religious? Become a Zionist. He went to Palestine. It took him a very short time to realize that the real community is the religious communities, and they're anti-Zionist. So he was looking for the truth. He joined them. He knew many languages. He was a diplomat. And he said, what's happening? The British was then at control. They had the mandate. And they said that every Jew has to register under the Zionists who came from Europe. So he said, I am going to save this community. He said, I'm going to Britain, to Parliament. And the Zionists said, either you're going to cease and desist or we're going to kill you. And they assassinated him in 1924. And you saw the funeral procession. Right. Tens of thousands went. And since then, Jews have been demonstrating fearlessly on the streets of Palestine, and they've been murdered, assassinated. Our rabbis have been assassinated. And till today, constantly, Jews are brutally beaten, children, old men, and we never carry arms. Nobody can accuse a Jew for 75 years of picking up a gun. We don't carry knives. So what's the excuse? And they have the army. Because we're standing on the streets and we're telling the world, we're declaring that they've stolen the identity of Judaism. We have no right to occupy. In fact, the chief rabbi, nothing to be confused with the Israeli rabbinate and chief rabbi, the chief rabbi of our community in 1947 pleaded with the United Nations. He said, we furthermore wish to express our definite opposition to a Jewish state in any part of Palestine. Rabbi Dushinsky, July 16, 1947, in the United Nations document. Our community has not been silent since then, demonstrating, and because we do not want one inch of this existence of the state, and we realize that what they're doing, the horrific crimes, what they're doing to the Palestinian people. As I say, we have been standing there crying, demonstrating, and certainly the last few weeks, in fact, there was a viral video showing how Jews were just recently, a few weeks ago, brutally beaten. We went out striding the streets of New York and we go to Washington, our car tires were slashed, and we get death threats. But this is nothing to what happens in Palestine. And if it wouldn't be for this, you should know there would be tens of thousands out demonstrating. If it wouldn't be for this fear, the Zionist brutal attack on the Jews who are real Jews, who are true to the religion, true to our Jewish religion, and are constantly suffering with the people of Gaza and Palestine and the West Bank.
Well, let me talk about that, because looking at the powers that be, because you said in your community, the anti-Zionist Jews have continually to be out there and speaking up against the regime. What about places like the United Nations and official entities? Have you spoken there? Have your community gone there to protest this absolute support that it has for the Zionist entity?
Yes. We are an NGO. We do go there constantly. I mean, since I'm a child, we've been going to the United Nations demonstrating almost every week. I was there just 2 weeks ago. We're constantly demonstrating outside of the United Nations with large demonstrations, small demonstrations, constantly. In the United Nations itself, they don't give us a voice because we're politically incorrect, because we clearly state unambiguously, unashamedly, we pray for the speedy and peaceful dismantlement of the Zionist state of Israel. We do not consider two-state a solution, because they have no right to occupy even one inch. I carry with me, I believe I have it in my pocket, we carry a key. We went to visit Sabra Sheltila, Baja Barajna, and they gave me a key of that they remember the homes in Jerusalem, they want the homes. We support this. We cry with them. They should be allowed to return. What do you mean they should be allowed? It's theirs. The United Nations should be demanding that they should go out to the state. And just like the United Nations made a mistake, forgive me for saying so, it's the United Nations, but they allowed and supported the South Africa during the apartheid, and the ambassador was called His Excellency, and that's how they referred to them, while they were practicing racism, and they believe in God, they said. And today, everybody understands that racism is criminal. Who doesn't understand? It's basic logic. And because of the grassroots, people, good people like you, good people like the average people who stood out on the street and went and screamed till the politicians were uncomfortable.
Do you think they there's stopped a change? It's changing.
And of course, so I'm saying the United Nations today, of course, South Africa is a, and yet the United Nations was the one that ratified the creation of a Zionist state that declares, and with the majority populace was Muslim, that they could create such a called a Jewish state. It's not a Jewish state, but that they could create a Jewish state. What would that mean? If you're looking for a world body that was created to create peace on the world, how do they ratify a situation where you're going to take a minority, that their name should be the name over the land? That's calling for strife and unrest and hate.
Right.
And that's what they did.
Well, Rabbi Weiss, hate to interrupt you, but we only have a couple of minutes. Do you think that there's a transition, that we're in a transition, that there's a change on the horizon as more and more people seem to be becoming aware of what the Zionist entity really is and standing up against this genocide?
Well, look, we're not prophets. And we've gone through the 75 years, sometimes that looked a bit much more hopeful, sometimes it looked less hopeful. But we knew and we know that God is compassionate. And the Torah says, why are you rebelling against me? It will not be successful. There will be an end of the occupation of the Zionist state of Israel. We pray it should be, he should do with his compassion, speedily and peacefully. We know that we've been always demonstrating and we have to continue to demonstrate even if it looks black. But at that said, we hope that maybe at this point in the history where the world sees the totally unexplainable, unforgivable murder, mass murder of the people of Gaza, maybe this is the time that we, in Judaism, it says one of the statements of the Torah, it says, from sour comes sweet, from bitter comes sweet. Maybe from this will be the time that the world will say, just like in South Africa, something's wrong. We made a colossal mistake. We have to stop the occupation. And that doesn't mean the Jews can't live together with Muslims. Again, I met with people in Gaza. I met with the leadership of Hamas and with Hezbollah in Lebanon. They embraced me openly, unabashedly. They said, we have nothing against Jews. History shows that the world, then the United Nations has to face the history that we if you remove the impediment to peace, this political, flawed, selfish occupation, then we will live together in peace.
Okay, and that's what we're hoping and praying for, the removal of that impediment. Thank you so much, Rabbi Weiss. It is a pleasure, as always, speaking to you. And thank you for being with us on this Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye for now.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا O you who believe, اِسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
There seems to be a similarity or link between the Wahhabis and people like Mutawakkil in the past. And the common bond between them is this hatred towards the Ahl Bayt, bughz of Ahl Bayt. Or as we call them, you know, Nasibi. And this is where we see that, you know, Mutawakkil was the most cruel and tyrant ruler of Banu Abbas. Now remember, Banu Abbas are actually a branch of Bani Hashim. Bani Hashim is divided into two branches. One is Ali Rasul, and the other is Banu Abbas from Abdullah, the descendants of of Abbas, the uncle of the Prophet. And so they are actually cousins of the Ahlul Bayt in a way. And they also came to power when they fought against Banu Umayyah in the name of the Ahlul Bayt. They used that name of somebody from Ali Muhammad. We are fighting for them. But when the time came to grab the power, they took it. There was one segment of Ali Rasul who had supported them, and they were the descendants of Imam Hassan. And so Banu Abbas considered Ali Hassan to be their biggest threat, because they were the one who supported them. And they used their name that we are fighting for Ali Rasul. And therefore the first campaign of Banu Abbas was to eliminate Ali Hassan. And if you look at history, you will see that those were the days when descendants of Imam Hassan had to run away from the mainland Muslim empire, all the way from Morocco on one side and Sindh and Pakistan on the other side. Even if you look at the family of the king of Morocco, they are all Hassani Sadat. And initially they were all Shia. Later on, because of Taqiyya, they lost their path and they become Sunnis. And so when we look at Banu Abbas, although they were cousins, but there was always this tension. And the worst among them was Mutawakkil. He could not tolerate the Shias going for the ziyarat of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala. And so what we see Najdi people doing in 1802 is nothing new. For them, the precedence is of Mutawakkil, the Abbasid Khalifa, where he, in the year 236 of the Hijra, the Islamic calendar, first he tried to erase any indication of the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. There were instructions that nobody will go for ziyarat, but he was not very successful. Again, in year 237, he tried that again. And even a decade after that, he did the third attempt. But he was never able to stop the Shias. Even if they had to suffer, they would still go for the ziyarat. And they would go and erase everything, but they would go and still put a mark there, a temporary shade or something on the grave, that people would know that this is the place you go for ziyarat of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. And so when we look at this issue, the question is, why you want to take the shrines? If you believe that the Shias are on the wrong, have a discussion. Nobody asks you to have arguments, publications, or whatever. Why target the shrines of the Ahlul Bayt? Because they know that just as the Kaaba is very important for Muslims, they believe 100%, 110% that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't reside there. Their aqidah is very pure. Yet they have this, strong attachment to that building. I'm sure any of you are going for Hajj, especially for the first time, when you go into the Masjid al-Haram and you really see the Kaaba with your eyes. It is a feeling that you cannot describe. It is completely different. And this is where we come to realize that although it's just, bricks, stones, nothing else. It is not a house of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He doesn't need a house. Yet this nisbat, when Allah says something is related to me, that entity becomes very important. And that is where, that nisbat becomes more powerful. There is a very interesting conversation of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and I think it was Abu Dhar who was the narrator, and this is when the Prophet is there after Fatah Makkah or the last Hajj by the Kaaba, and Rasulullah addresses the Kaaba and he says, O Kaaba, I know that your hurmat, your sanctity, your sacredness, your holiness is very great in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But O Kaaba, you should know that the hurmat and sanctity of a mu'min is greater than yours. Rasulullah is saying, yes, this is very important, very sacred. But when it comes to the hurmat of a mu'min, and if you have a mu'min who is Sayyid al-Shuhada, you know, what would be his hurmat? And this is where we see that when they attack, you know, it's actually worse than attacking the Kaaba. It seems that, you know, for them, anything which symbolizes Husayn ibn Ali, anything just symbolizes the Ahlul Bayt, you know, they want to destroy that. Any memory, any connection that the people would have with the Ahlul Bayt through these visitations. And that's why these, you know, places become the target of those who have this bughz and hatred towards the Ahlul Bayt. You know, when Mutawakkil, he came later on in the 3rd century of the Islamic era, and Karbala took place early days. When he was doing all this, trying to erase the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, one of the poets of Baghdad those days, by the name of Ali bin Muhammad al-Baghdadi, actually uttered, you know, 3 lines of poetry, which became very, you know, famous at that time. And it reflected, you know, in his views, the motivation of Mutawakkil. And he says, تالله إن كانت أمية قد أتت قتل ابن بنت نبيها مظلوما. He says, by Allah, it is true that Banu Umayya, you know, committed this crime of killing the son of the daughter of their own prophet. They did this madhuluman, unjustly. وَلَقَدْ أَتَاهُ بَنُو أَبِيهِ بِمِثْلِهِ. He says, but when I look what Mutawakkil is doing, he says his cousins, the Abbasid, did the same thing. هَذَا لِعُمْرِي قَبْرُهُ مَحْدُومًا. By my life, I see the grave of Hussein has been demolished. And then he talks about this motivation of Muawiyah, of Mutawakkil, why he's doing this. أَسَفُوا أَنْ لَا يَكُونُوا شَارَكُوا فِي قَتْلِهِ فَتَّتَّبِعُوهُ رَمِيمًا. It seems as if, you know, they regret that why they were not there in Karbala to kill Hussein. And out of that regret, now they are targeting the grave of Hussein. And so this demolition of the shrines of Ahlul Bayt for us is a reflection of that, you know, bughz, which started with Banu Umayya, continued with people like Mutawakkil, and it came all the way. You know, we saw even Saddam during our time trying to stop the process of Arba'een of Sayyid al-Shuhada. But Mutawakkil is gone. Nobody remembers him. The shrine of Hussein is there. Saddam is gone, but the Arba'een of Hussein is there. And we hope that one day, whether Saudis are there or not, the shrines of Ahlul Bayt in Baqi will be rebuilt, inshallah.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let's talk about the same topic that, in fact, we started from, last episode, and that means enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, and some of the jurisprudential laws related to that, Sheikh Javid. And let me start with this question. Is it permissible to neglect or ignore, let's say, enjoining the good and forbidding the evil for fear of losing one's job? For example, the head of an educational institution who deals with the university youth commits actions against the Sharia or paves the way for commission of sins in that particular place, while we fear of losing our job if we forbid him from this evil.
Well, as we discussed in one of the previous episodes, one of the conditions that must be fulfilled when enjoining the good is that one should be safe from any harm. And if you are not safe, that means actually Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy anil Munkar are not obligatory on you. So as a general rule, if the duty-bound person fears considerable harm for himself in enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, it will not be obligatory for him to engage in such a practice.
I see. Well, Sheikh Sobit, if the good is neglected and evil is common in some places, let's say in a market or in an academic environment, and the conditions for enjoining the good and forbidding evil are there, will one be relieved of performing this duty if one is single?
Well, when there is a case to enjoin the good and forbidding evil, and the required conditions are available, it is the Shari as well as social and human obligation of the mukallafs, the duty-bound people, to do so. I mean, they should do whatever they can to stop the evil and promote what is called virtue. So such things as being, for example, married or unmarried, I think does not change the ruling. And of course, merely being unmarried does not exempt one from carrying out and this obligation, which is obligatory on every individual who has attained puberty. Now, regardless of your age, regardless of the position you are, so if the conditions of fulfilling, of enjoining the good and forbidding evil are available, then you have to do it.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned. Ooh.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Sheikh Javed, if one comes across evidence of sinful conducts, impropriety and insincerity of a person holding a powerful position so that one fears his power and influence, is it permissible to neglect enjoining the good and forbidding the evil in relation to that individual? Or is it obligatory for one to call that person to the good and forbid him, let's say, from evil, even one is afraid of that individual's harm?
Yeah. Well, if there's a reasonable and genuine fear of harm coming from that individual, which you described as someone who is powerful, who is, threatening. So it will not be obligatory in such cases to enjoin the good and forbid the evil, because the condition is not met. One of the conditions is that one should be safe from any harm. And in this case, maybe the individual who enjoins the good and forbids the evil is not safe, because he puts himself in harm's way by enjoining someone who is very aggressive, who is very violent. So, of course, such a person is relieved of the obligation of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar. But meanwhile, it's not good for someone to neglect reminding and advising his brother in faith simply for fear of the position of the person who neglects the good, or that of the perpetrator of the evil, or for the mere likelihood of some harm inflicted by him. So if there is a chance, or maybe likelihood or probability, one should not take these seriously and into account stopping Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar.
Sheikh Javed, don't you think that it also necessitates a kind of negotiation techniques, like or psychological, for example, techniques, so that we can somehow smooth talk,
yes,
to the person, and don't go hard or radical and cold turkey on the person, and we somehow don't be straightforward and frank when it comes to it, and could we use some indirect techniques,
you're right,
let's say, to somehow talk the person into doing something good and talk him out of doing something bad.
You're right.
Doesn't it necessitate that kind of technique?
I think you are very much right. Because in this time around, being very rigid and strict and, let's say, very much outspoken in terms of conveying that message of Islam and spreading virtue,
or convincing the person
it does not work. You know, you can, as you rightly mentioned, you can act in an
indirectly
indirect way to draw his attention and to remind him of his duty to do what is good and to stay away from what is bad.
Like, I remember the story of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein trying to teach that old person, the senior citizen, how to make the correct or proper wuzu, right?
Yes, yes.
And they went out to the person and they asked him which one of us, in fact, makes proper wudu, without telling the old person directly that you're wrong in the way that you make the wudu,
Good.
So this is the indirect technique, basically.
Of course, yeah.
All right.
For example, if you tell someone straight away, why don't you offer, it's haram that you don't offer your prayers, and it's a great sin to, he will take offense, and he, yes, it probably he will react.
Take guards and reactions.
Reaction will
things.
Be, yeah. He probably, he, it will have no effect. Rather, he will further get, you know, distanced from the religion.
So taking the right tone and discourse is very necessary,
is very,
I guess.
Necessary.
Like the knowledge that you talked about in one of the previous episodes about the religious issues. If you don't know the knowledge,
yes,
if you don't know, you know, the correct things, the sins, or whatever the good deeds, then how can you enjoin somebody to the good or forbid him from evil?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and shortly with our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh, at times forbidding a sinner creates negative feelings against Islam due to that individual's ignorance of Islamic duties and rules. On the other hand, if we leave that person alone, it will prepare the ground for others to corrupt the environment and commit sins. So what's the duty, what's our duty in this regard?
Well, enjoining the good and forbidding evil, when the conditions are available, are considered public religious duties.
Right.
For sake of safeguarding Islamic laws and social health. So it is a collective duty, and every individual should in his own turn fulfill this duty, because everybody needs to contribute to the social health,
mm-hmm,
in one way or the other.
Right.
Well, the mere suspicion that it might, you know, create negative feelings against Islam in some individuals does not actually justify the negligence of such an extremely crucial duty.
Mm-hmm. Sure, so if those assigned by the government to prevent corruption do not accomplish their duty well, is it permissible for people to take action or to take charge of this duty themselves?
Well, it's not permissible for other people to interfere with affairs assigned to judicial authority, like or security personnel,
mm-hmm,
because they have to do their jobs. Intervening or interfering in the affairs of those people who have, for which there are certain people responsible,
mm-hmm,
is not okay, because it will create further chaos and lawlessness. So there is no objection to enjoining the good and forbidding evil when carried out with due observance of the limits and conditions. So we did talk about the limits and conditions. So conditions must fulfill. One of which is, of course, that one should it should have the necessary effect. It should not have the negative consequences for the individual. And then if all of these conditions are fulfilled, then one can go ahead. And of course, in judicial matters, one should not take the law into his hand, arresting people,
that would cause
beating
mayhem
them.
And yeah, chaos in
you're
the
right.
society, right?
Beating them, imprisoning them, jailing them, and lashing them, that's not okay.
Yes.
And this practice is not endorsed by Islam and the Islamic Sharia and the scholars, the Shi'ite scholars. I'm
right.
not talking about the scholars from, let's say, other branches of faith.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, as the host of this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We bid you farewell. Keep us in your du'as. And thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إلى إلا هو غفار.
Farewell to the arms.
Part 1.
The moment of farewell is one of the hardest moments for anyone. Whether it is saying farewell to your family, your home, your homeland, and the most significant of all, saying farewell to life. But for a fighter, the hardest one is to say farewell to their arms. Palestinian fighter and leader Yasser Arafat was a man who experienced each and every one of these farewells throughout his life. Now, he had turned into a comatose in a hospital bed in France before he experienced those farewells. His first painful farewell took place 50 years ago when he witnessed a series of events that changed his course of life. It was springtime in the small village of Deir Yassin. The inhabitants of the village did not want any war with the intruders. But sometime later, the United Nations divided Palestine into two Arab and Jewish sectors and caused rifts instead of solving the differences.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
After the UN resolution, the Palestinians possessed only 45% of their country in two disjointed segments, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The rest of the 55% was given to the minority Jews with a 500,000 population. By recognizing Israel as a so-called state, a war started. Now the Jews could expel the Palestinians out of their homes and replace them with the newly arrived Jewish immigrants. 6 months passed since the final declaration of the United Nations, but normalcy had yet to be restored to the cities. The people of Palestine did not want to come to terms with the injustice. Everyone knew that the war was looming. People in Deir Yassin were seeing the migrant Jews in their neighborhoods. They didn't want to be the initiators of war. They were preparing for a new harvest season. But the sun had just risen when 120 Israeli armed men surrounded the village. The people of Deir Yassin faced what they had feared most. Deir Yassin was the first place to burn in the flames of war. The stench of major atrocity filled the air in Palestine. Israelis killed more than 250 civilians, including women and children, and over 100 children were left orphans. Other cities and villages face Deir Yassin's fate one after the other. Palestinian men sent their families to safer cities and took up arms to defend their homeland. After a few months of popular resistance, the armies of Arab nations rushed to the Palestinian people's rescue, which led to the first Arab-Israeli war. A year later, Israelis were the winners of the war. The 65,000 strong army that had come from seven Arab states to help the Palestinians could not do much. They were less than half the Israeli forces in numbers. On the other hand, the Israelis' newly purchased equipment, compared to the Palestinians' old and dilapidated equipment, made many people disappointed. The immigrant Jews, who had only purchased only 2% of Palestine's land from the British, were now occupying 70% of the land. The war claimed the lives of 25,000 people and left 700,000 Palestinians homeless and displaced. They migrated to neighboring countries. People lived cold and grim lives away from home. Their only hope was to return to their homes one day. After a few years, a new ray of hope shines for the Palestinians. This time from the West, a man came to power in Egypt. People are infatuated with his ideas. His words smell like freedom. Gamal Abdel Nasser's ideas are an inspiration for nations seeking independence. He sought to revive the pride of Arab nations. He forced thousands of European troops who've been occupying Egypt for decades to pack up and leave for Britain. The people were filled with joy. Gamal had an idea. He wants to unite Arab nations so they can gain independence together. But there's a major obstacle in his path.
About the rights of the Arabs of Palestine were expelled out of their country. We have about 1.5 million refugees. They treated the Arabs the same way. Expelled them, killed their children, destroyed their villages, and there was escape from Palestine to the Arab country. The Arabs of Palestine want to return back to their homeland.
The Israeli army decided to conquer the entire Middle East. Their military equipment is made up of the most modern French warships and warplanes, and the United States is also beefing up their military by handing them more than $60 million in military aid each year. But worst of all was the news of atomic weapons being produced in Israel's nuclear sites. It meant that the Israelis were not going to give up so easily. Gamal had initiated various projects to empower Egypt on par with Israel and was now holding war games so he can flaunt his country's military might to world leaders. The flames of the war would either burn Israel or it would shatter Gamal's dreams. 10 Tensions were on the rise along the borders. The armed forces on the Jordanian and Syrian borders were on high alert. To support them, Gamal deployed 80,000 troops to the Sinai Desert and the Gaza Strip. The King of Jordan traveled to Cairo to sign a defense pact with Egypt. Syria and Iraq also joined the pact. The Middle East turned into a powder keg. A single spark could burn it in flames. Israel found itself surrounded from all sides, so it declares a state of emergency in all of its military bases. The commander of the Israeli army claimed that they're ready to enter any war the next day. All eyes are fixed on Gamal, so he'd start the war and end the Israeli entity before it could celebrate its 20th birthday. As a next step, he blocks all maritime crossings for Israel. Gamal's nightmare came true. Israel strikes preemptively and turns the tide in its own favor. Israeli jets destroyed more than 400 Egyptian aircraft and their hangars. The Jordanian army orders a counter-strike in revenge, but the Jordanian fighter jets disappear from radar screens one after the next. The outcome of the battle on the ground was not so different from the one in the air. Once again, people had to flee in order to save their own lives. Israel only needed 6 days to grab enough land to make itself 3 times larger. Syria's Golan Heights, southern Lebanon, the Sinai Desert in Egypt, and all of Palestine up to the River Jordan were occupied by Israel. Other Arab nations ended up with the same fate as the Palestinians had. Now half the population of Palestine had to live under Israeli occupation. It seems they had to give up their struggle for freedom. 9 months later, the news of an explosion shocks everyone. A roadside blast targets a bus in Israeli-occupied territory, leading to the death of 2 Israelis. The Israeli army announces it will give an unforgettable lesson to the fighters who carried out this attack. A small group named Fatah claims responsibility for the operation. Their base was in a small town of Karameh, located near the Jordanian border. Gamal was worried a new war would create trouble for Arab states, so he asked the Fatah forces to immediately leave town. The Jordanian army made the same request, but Fatah members wanted to stay, even if it meant they had to give up their lives. Israel thought such a small group wouldn't be much of trouble for them, so they immediately sent 15,000 troops and 50 tanks to the village. But they were ambushed and surrounded from behind. They were trapped and in the first few hours suffered over 100 casualties. Israeli forces received a lethal blow, so they retreated. The Jordanian artillery also rushed to the rescue of Fatah, and struck the retreating Israeli forces. Now, all that remained from the so-called invincible army was a few abandoned, burned-out tanks. Fatah broke the myth of the invincibility of the Israeli army. The leader of their group was one of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees who did something astounding to achieve his goals. The man who always had a smile on his face and would never give up. In August 1929, the sixth child of the Arafat family was born. His father named him Muhammad Yasser, meaning the bringer of relief, to give hope to the family in hardships. His Palestinian family had migrated from Al-Quds to Egypt a few years back, but the hard times came to him sooner than he expected. He lost his mother when he was just 4 years old and laid her to rest, and his father had to send him to live with his uncle in Al-Quds. Yasser witnesses the conflict between Palestinian freedom fighters and British forces in Al-Quds up close and personal. After a while, he goes back to Cairo to study. His first year at the university coincides with the hard days for Palestine and the start of the first Arab-Israeli war. He joined the Arab nation's army to go fight for Palestine. However, after a year, they suffered a defeat, and he thought he should perhaps pursue his studies. He applies for a visa to study at the University of Texas in the U.S. It took a few months for his request to be processed. Yasser, meanwhile, changed his mind and decided to stay and fight to return to his homeland. At first, he held discussions and forums about Palestine. In one of these discussions, he revealed his plans. He asserted that armed resistance was the only way to save Palestine and founded the Fatah movement. He planned a series of operations, but everything should have been done secretly. But the second defeat for the Arab nations was a heavy blow for him. This time around, he planned an operation in the heart of Tel Aviv and immediately claimed responsibility for it. When he was asked to retreat, he responded, "The Palestinian people have always been fleeing, but this time we are going to resist, even if it costs us our lives." Only 48 hours after Arafat's victory, 5,000 people asked to join the Fatah movement. Arafat's popularity grew by the day, so Israelis decided to immediately take him out. Arafat became so popular that everyone called him leader of the Palestinian nation. They said, "He's come to shine the ray of hope in the heart of the Palestinian nation." Fatah grew bigger and bigger by the day. After a year, the Arab nations recognized Fatah as the only official Palestinian organization. Gamal, as the most important Arab leader, also backed it. The Fatah movement's successes aroused the Jordanian king's jealousy. And in no time, a conflict started between Fatah and the Jordanian army. Gamal acted as a mediator and asked both sides to stop fighting. Arafat agreed, but the next day, Gamal said farewell to life after a heart attack, and Arafat, who had just set out in this path, lost his important supporter.